process of learning things, where we can stop trying to overanalyze and over quantify things and over, you know, try to make things logical that shouldn't be logical. When we can learn to put our logic and our feeling together, we can learn to label emotion for what it is, which is a big tapestry of overlapping experiences that it's no perfect label for one emotion or another.
What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance, so you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Darris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio. Hey folks, welcome back to Flow Research Collective Radio. My name is Rian Darris, and today we've got a special episode with Dr. Glenn Fox, who is a dear friend and advisor of ours here at the Flow Research Collective. Dr. Glenn Fox is a neuroscientist, and he's the head of program design, strategy, and outreach at the USC Performance Science Institute. And he is one of the world's leading experts on the neuroscience of gratitude and human performance. And in this episode, we talk about labeling emotions, intuition, peak performance, judgment, decision making, and of course, flow. We kick off the episode with a personal story about Glenn, about his upbringing and how he started his first community as a fifth grader, which was called the Tomato Republic. And we go a little bit off the beaten track today. We talk about counterculture, power, Ken Kesey, and being weird. So if you're interested in the intersection of intuition, decision-making, neuroscience, and a little bit of weirdness thrown into the mix, you're going to dig this episode. Now, before I want to jump in, I want to make a quick announcement from the Flow Research Collective. We are currently accepting a number of new participants into our flagship peak performance training, Zero to Dangerous. In Zero to Dangerous, you will work one-on-one with one of our PhD-level peak performance coaches, and they will help you implement the protocols, practices, and habits you need in your life to maximize the flow that you're experiencing day to day, so that you can level up your performance and accomplish your boldest professional goals. So if you're an entrepreneur, a leader, or a knowledge worker, and you want to take your professional success to the next level, Zero to Dangerous could be a fit for you. To apply to Zero to Dangerous, you just need to go to getmoreflow.com. You can pop a quick application through there. We'll speak with you briefly to fill you in more on how the program works, what's included and what's involved. And then we can also assess whether it's a good fit for you given where you're at right now. So that's getmoreflow.com to apply for Zero to Dangerous, getmoreflow.com. Now let's jump straight in with Dr. Glenn Fox. Excited to kick it off with you. Dr. Glenn Fox, it is great to have you here with us. You've been a great friend and advisor to the Flow Research Collective for a while now. Actually, I believe we did our first phone call with Dr. Mike Gervais when we were looking at the creativity and flow research at least 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So it's been maybe a little while.
Three. And I think we've been working together for 3 years. God! And in that time, you had a baby.
Yes. Yeah. I've had a baby. That was very recent. That's only 3 months ago. So, you know, I don't know how those things are correlated, but
they're not at all. I just wanted to like give the impression that time had passed. I was reaching for like a metaphor for 3 years. I mean, I didn't have a baby in that time. Rian didn't. So it's, you're a clock of one.
We've had a good run. We got a good runway, and it's my pleasure. I'm just so excited to be in the circle and be trying to help people, help the people in your network, help people in our network. Like, it's been a blast. It's been super fun and really excited for just to be here, sharing the virtual air, so to speak.
Super. Yeah, no, it's great to have you here, Glenn. I was going to originally kick off anyway with the request that you give us a narrative walkthrough the whole way from you graduating high school to where you are right now, and a little bit of detail on why you made the decisions you made as you went. And I know that you have your own version of that whole story. So let's kick off with you getting us up to speed on how you've gotten to here.
Yeah. So I thought it'd be fun to tell a story, actually, that I think this story is such a perfect analogy. I've never told it really. And only recently, like any good story, only recently is the lesson from it really sunk in. It's a story that has a wonderful repetition throughout all the big events and big transitions in my life. And it's a very micro story. It will feel, I think, at times like, where is he going with this? But hopefully, if you've never heard of me, never done anything, hopefully just by itself, my goal is that by itself, the story grips people and we can have a little fun with it. So it takes place in fifth grade for me. And we're not going to go fifth. So we're not going to go through. Don't worry. It takes place in fifth grade when I was a pretty disgruntled fifth grader. And I really decided it was time for me and my friends to take back the playground. Right. So as a bit of context, I grew up in a really small town in a pretty poor family northeast of Yosemite called Sonora. If you're thinking like, what the heck is northeast of Sonora? Then yeah, or Yosemite, what is northeast of Yosemite? Then you have a pretty good picture of just how rural it is. There's not much up there. And so I grew up in a family that, you know, my parents tried to introduce us to a lot of culture, but we didn't have much. We didn't heat the house really in the winter. We were at 4,000 feet of elevation, grew up in a community with a lot of drug addiction, a lot of domestic violence. And my school was kind of a microcosm of it. So I went to a little school in a forest, in a pine forest with, you know, there were 20 students per class. Many of the students had just come from nothing. And so my family was sort of the poor plus of the crew. And this created a lot of division between the people. And then maybe the thing that created the most division in my school was that I would happen to be a smart kid, or at least I liked school enough that I'd pay attention, you know? And so it created a lot of division. So in fifth grade, you know, I was kind of tired of dealing with some of the dynamics and decided to run my own little psychological operation on the playground. So I started a club called the Tomato Republic. And the goal of the Tomato Republic was basically to take it back and to like command the playground. You know, so we were up against all these, there were like these fourth graders and sixth graders. Again, the school is so small that the grades kind of blend together.
What age are these grades, Glenn, just for people who aren't US-based?
Yeah. So I would have been, I think in fifth grade, I think you're
11.
11.
You're 11.
12, yeah, I was 11. And so I teamed up with my friend, Josh Cripps. Josh, by the way, little side note, Josh Cripps is now like a super, he's a former aeronautical engineer, now a very famous photographer, sponsored by Nikon. It's really interesting. You should check out his work. But so Josh and I started this Tomato Republic, and our goal was A, to like bring in like-minded people. So we had our own psychometric onboarding. We had our own psychological quiz that you had to take to be part of the Tomato Republic. We had ID cards. We had meetings. We had all these different things. And soon we started to build a little momentum where we really started owning, like, for instance, we really hated that we never got to pick what game you could play in the courtyard. We had like one courtyard and we were like, we're over this. We got to take control of the courtyard. So we would basically get there super early and like try to check out all the playground equipment so that none of the other kids knew what to do. And then we would say our own game. So we started just really disrupting what was going on the playground. Like at one point there's like a drain in the side of the courtyard where the ball, if it went through the drain, it like totally sucked because somebody had to run out and get the ball and it would like shut down the whole game. So we started strategically like throwing the ball through the drain and basically just causing a lot of chaos. And soon we started like really inflicting our will on the poor students of Bellevue Elementary. And it became like our little test bed where we started to really pull together a philosophy for what it meant to be part of us. And like, we could really be weird. We could really be creative in a way that was fun, but we were starting to inflict a lot of power over the rest of it because if we wanted to, we could basically like take over there were only a few of us, but we could take over the playground at any time. And soon like the other kids
this started. This was a Philip Zimbardo experiment.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just all I'm thinking. Just
think yeah. It really was like, I remember like we had like the, at one point there was a day where like the ball was about to roll out the drain and like my friend Robert threw a pine cone at the ball and that's what knocked it out. And everybody got so mad at him. And he's like, there are pine cones everywhere in my school, by the way, that's how kind of school it was. And he's like, oh, the pine cone did it. And like, we thought that was hilarious. And then, you know, so we were really just like crafting this thing. And so like we started soon, instead of playing football, we'd just make up our own games. We'd make up our own ways of playing. We'd make up our own thing. People could play. We didn't try to exclude anybody, but it was like, we just weren't going to go along with what these other kids were telling us was an appropriate, you know, use of recess. So soon people started to get mad. The fourth graders and the sixth graders that were kind of pushing us around the floor, they really did not like this. They did not like that we'd sort of taken things back. And so they went to the principal and just ratted us out and said, they've started this club and now we're totally miserable and we hate it. So the principal had to pull us out of our class, told us about how, you know, I think called me a gang leader. They said, Glenn, I think you started a gang. This is the beginning of a gang, which I actually was a little flattered by, to be honest. I was like, wow, okay. You know? And so we had really commanded things and they were crying. One of the kids was like super mad about the pine cone thing. Again, he like brought it up with the principal and he's like, they blame it on the pine cones. And like, it was really pretty funny. So we got shut down. So we had to turn in our ID cards. Like that actually meant something. Like it was like a passport. We had to turn in our little index card, ID cards. And so I was like really, really bummed because I'd started something I thought that was really cool. Even though I was, you know, as fifth grade, I really thought we'd had a movement here to build on. And we got shut down. It was super, I was really, really mad. I was really mad. And I told my parents about it and they were like, well, pretty weird dude, but okay. And they had around that time, they had been planning this big event at the local junior college, right? And so I was like, I still remember the way this lined up was so weird, but it was a chance. There was some speaker and we're going to go. And so we went and we saw this speaker. And I remember him really reaching me in a way that sometimes when you're a little kid, you meet an adult that really speaks to you, where you're able to go, wow, this person is treating me just like a young person, not like a little idiot. You know, like many people when they talk to kids, they're so terrible. They're like, kids are smart. They're just young. They haven't experienced a lot. They're not just smaller versions of dumb people. Like they just, so this guy, I remember it being so striking, right? And after the event, my parents said, why don't you go talk to him and tell him about the Tomato Republic? So he talked about counterculture. He talked about standing up to power. He talked about institutions of power. He talked about always being, setting up your own act of rebellion and the importance of never taking for granted whatever situation you're in. He talked about making sure that you could always enact your will against systems of oppression. And I remember, I mean, that's my thing now, but when I was a kid, I just remember hearing this guy saying like, it's okay to be different. It's okay to be different. It's okay to be weird. And I was at that point in fifth grade where being weird wasn't cool and being a dork certainly wasn't going to get me a lot of friends. I was really, you know, you're kind of tender at that age. And so after the event, I talked to the guy and he was so supportive. And I told him about the Tomato Republic and he was like, he was so just like, Glenn, you're doing the right thing. Like you got to just, whatever it is, just keep doing that in life. Cause you totally did it. Like you, that's exactly how you should be thinking about things. And I was like, okay, cool. And so it was one of those things. Sometimes you meet an adult when you're a kid and that, again, it sinks deep. It leaves a mark. And in high school, I was reading One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and my mom goes, well, that's cool. How do you like that book? And I'm like, it's amazing. It's totally speaking to me. I just love it. She's like, well, I'm not surprised because you and Ken Kesey really got along at that event you went to in fifth grade. That was Ken Kesey. And I told Ken Kesey that same exact story that Tomato Republic. And he was amazing. It was Ken Kesey. Somehow, some reason, I don't know what he was doing in my hometown.
By the way, who's a notorious grump also.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, I think he was happy. It was like not a super well-attended event because my town, like we had theater and stuff. I mean, I was in theater as a kid. I was actually in Back to the Future 3 when I was 10. I had a speaking role. So we had done like things. I'd been in plays and I'd been always trying to put myself out there. But yeah, so it was Ken Kesey. So one of my first pep talks in life came from Ken Kesey, and it was a really interesting way to reframe things. And I actually reminded of this recently. And I think the reason I like this story so much about, rather than starting with high school and going through things, is that this is how my life has been. I've been really fortunate that every time I think I'm at a decline or at a nadir, that something magical kind of happens. And so when I was finishing college and not exactly sure what I wanted to do, like happened to find a job in a brain imaging lab in Stanford that was fantastic. And so I worked on learning neuroanatomy, and it came from really not knowing what I wanted to do in a really crisis where I just realized I had time on my hands. So I started volunteering in this imaging lab. A scientist named Brian Wandel, he's a vision scientist, and he's incredible. And from there, you know, applying to grad school, and I just had a real hard time getting into grad school. But that happened to be when Antonio Damasio was opening the Brain and Creativity Institute at USC. It just so happened that they needed staff who knew about neuroanatomy that happened to be there. You know, it's really funny, when my first day at Stanford, actually, my boss, I was so in over my head, but my boss said, the scientist I work with named Bob Doherty said, Glenn, do you want to do functional or structural imaging? And I remember going, in my mind, I was like, I have no idea what the difference is. I was totally like, oh crap. I was like, oh man. I was like, so I was thinking, I love cars, I love working on old cars, I love kind of mechanical things. So I just thought, well, I'll take structural.
And that's Bob, so fun. I will tell you, by the way, now that you're talking, I didn't realize this until you were telling this story, not the Ken Kesey part, but this more recent part. Andy Newberg was my first mentor, but the guy who really taught me neuroscience was Dr. Robert White, the neurosurgeon of the 20th century. And he, you know, when I first met him, because he was giving me sort of like an abridged grad school course, so I could basically interview him and write about him. But he spent 2 weeks training me up. This was the first major article I ever wrote on neuroscience. He said, look, we're going to focus on two things. We're going to focus on neural anatomy and neurochemistry. And I said, well, what? He said, you got to know where something is taking place. And he said, if I tap you, I can get an electrical reaction, but I got to punch you to get a chemical reaction. And so it's just like, if you know where it is, and you know how the big stuff moves, you can sort of like fumble. And again, neural anatomy, Dr. Andrew Huberman, who's another, like, if you look, go through the neuroscientists who are on our team, everybody involved has, for some reason, a deep foundation in neural anatomy. And just like, where is shit located?
It's so important. It's so important. We talk so much about function. We talk so much about fMRI and EEG and these sort of moving targets, these moving windows that are really just correlates of actual brain activity, of actual neural firing.
You know what else I think it is with the neural anatomy folks? You can't speak neural anatomy at any level, really, without being able to talk about evolution and brain evolution, right? And that's the other thing that I think is there's a commonality among people we work with, which is we're all sort of like really steeped in a bunch of evolutionary science also, I think. And you don't always get that, right? If you're just dealing with the imaging folks, you know, because you don't need to understand brain evolution to look at an fMRI.
Exactly. And you can, it just guides the questions you ask. If they're rooted in the anatomy and in the evolution of these brain systems, you ask much better questions, right? That the idea with a good science project should be that you have, you know, one question, one result, and many implications. I mean, that's the hallmark of good science, is that from one single result, you get implications across a broad smattering of things. And it's easier to do things where you can kind of look at kind of micro systems, or even, micro is not the right word, but sort of very limited social circumstance or very limited questions of what does the brain do under these circumstances. And it can tell you something cool about that thing, but it's really only going to be about that thing. And so a lot of fMRI research has really focused, I think, way too much on drilling down into winnowing down theories and theories and theories and hypotheses into relatively narrow questions about brain function. Whereas I think the best research is going the other direction, where you're taking one finding that opens us up, like, whoa, that's an incredible finding, you know, like finding that the, you know, neural map of C. elegans is like by far the most optimal way that the neurons could be laid out. Like, you know, it's just this most beautiful way where they did the electrical engineering, basically save water.
Oh, when that was is that Axelrod's work? It's the closed world. No, I'm missing the term. It's a small world network, right? You're talking about the small world network model?
I'm not sure if this isn't the same paper, but it's basically, well, like one question is, why is the brain in your head, right? Like, it seems like we could save a lot of wire if the brain was in your core, right? But it turns out that your face is part of your brain in so many ways that this is actually the center of the body, even though it's not geographically the center. So it's a question that myelin and axons and neurons are very expensive to grow. They take a lot of energy. They take a lot of work. And your brain is really just along for the ride, in my theories, about how we work, how our emotions work, is that it's body first, brain second in so many ways. Now, of course, they're like this, but the brain came after so many of these systems for homeostasis that it's here processing things that are taking place. As my advisor, Antonio Damasio, says, that consciousness is always running behind. We're always running late. That the way the brain is processing, it's processing things in the body, it's processing things in our sensory system.
Glenn, would you call, is that an extreme and active view? Meaning that perception always involves movement?
Yeah, absolutely.
Alvin Noah's view, some of the deep embodied, the sort of the extreme is the wrong word, but the more kind of hardcore people in the embodied cognition school, I've heard similar discussions. But I get what Damasio meant by the brain. Consciousness is always a second behind, because that makes sense too.
Could you break that down a little more? I think that's a really interesting point to the Damasio's idea there, that consciousness is lagging behind.
So there's a lot of nuance to it. It's a matter of really understanding and flipping on its head how we think our perceptions and emotions work. We have this model that we get some information, we think about it, based on what we decide, what we think, then we have an emotional reaction. And in fact, it doesn't work like that. That the body has early access to sensory input. In fact, it almost has primary access to sensory information, which then we decide and think about. That we feel first and think second. And it's there in our gut instinct, but in particular with flow and with learning and high performance, that you'll find almost every skill is actually going to boil down to an emotional skill. You know, playing music, for instance, it's perfectly rational to quantify all the elements of good music. But when you play music, if you're sitting there really trying to go, I should bring this string of my guitar 3% more, and that, it doesn't work. It's feel. And that the process of gaining expertise and of learning and of learning to decide, most importantly, which is what we all struggle with, right, is this relationship between emotion and decision-making. That's what life is. That's the struggle. And the more that we can observe how we feel in a given circumstance, the more we can learn to label emotions, to work with them as they come up, and to figure out how specific types of emotion and feeling states lead to different decision making will help us tremendously. Is that breaking it down? So here's the idea. Here's the basic premise was something called the Iowa gambling task. And the way that they discovered all this was that these brain lesion patients were having trouble only in one specific element of their life, which was decision-making. So this was Antonio's first launch. He was studying Alzheimer's, studying language. He was studying all these different, more traditional neurological topics when they were coming across these patients that were fine. They could speak, they could remember, they could read. Their sensory systems were perfect, but their lives were falling apart because of their lack of decision-making ability. So what they found was through this thing called the Iowa gambling task, which is a way you're sort of learning to make decision under ambiguous conditions, which, by the way, is all decision making, if you really think about it, that the people who could not...
Glenn, will you back it up for half a second? Because this is what I've always wondered. How did they come up with the idea? Where did that come from? Because it's really intuitive when you, please tell people what it is. But when you hear about it, you're like, oh, that makes sense. But how did they come up with the idea for it in the first place?
I don't know. I know that the collaborator, longtime collaborator of the Damasios, maybe the longest standing one who does amazing work, is named Antoine Bechara. And Antoine came from a medical and economics background, one of the first, you know, neuroeconomics people.
Okay, so yeah, he's got some game theory underneath him also.
Yeah, and I think it came from there. I think Antoine and Antonio and Hanna, and they had a few other collaborators that may have been. I don't know the exact, you know, moment or you know, whatever that exact, you know, fulcrum of inspiration.
Yeah, there's a couple of those where you're like, wow, this is an amazing experiment, but like, how did you come up with this thing that you use that's so simple? Anyways, tell people what the Iowa gambling task is and let's go back to that.
Yeah, we're running. I love this. So the way it works is, imagine here that I give you a task and I tell you the goal of this task is to make as much money as possible. I present to you four decks of cards and I tell you, just pick a deck of cards, pick a card from the top of the deck. This is virtually, it's done with like a little computer game. It feels very 8-bit like, but you have four cards and you see just the top of the deck of cards, and you can just pick a deck and the card flips over and you either win some money or lose some money. The instructions are that make as much money as you can, and some of the decks are better than others. So you do what most people would do, is you've got these four decks, you know, some are better than others, and you know that you're either going to win or lose money on every trial. Making sense so far? Does mm-hmm. make sense?
Yep. Right.
So it turns out that what most people do is what we would expect, that you sample the range of decks to see what happens when you pick deck A, B, C, or D. And you just try them, right? You start, maybe we'll just go, okay, we'll just go A, B, C, D, because you're trying, you know that some decks are better than others. So you're trying to figure that out, right? Because if you can identify which decks are better than others, you make more money, right? So the thing is that some decks will give you you'll win $100 or lose $50 or $200 or whatever. And some decks you'll win $500 to $1,000, but you'll lose $2,000. And what you learn eventually is that the high risk decks, where you can make a lot but lose a lot, don't pay very well over time, because you might build your way up, but you lose money and you wipe out everything and you just can't get back. So you learn, like in a standard economic paradigm, that you have an expected utility or an expected gain, expected value, that the safer decks where you can win $100 reliably will make you more money than the decks where you might win $1,000, but you lose everything very quickly.
And if I remember correctly, first of all, your brain figures it out intuitively before you know it consciously, but it was about 25 cards, right? That on average, till somebody, that's when you started to get strong intuitions about which deck to pick from.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so that's what they found, is that people started to pick the optimal decks before they knew why they were picking the optimal decks. So they called it a pre-hunch phase. They have a pre-hunch, a hunch, and then an execution. Because at some point, you figure it out. You're like, oh, that deck sucks. Like, yeah, I might win $1,000, but I lose. So you know cognitively those decks are less good. But there's a phase of learning that precedes that, in which you figure out that the smaller gains will make you more money over time, right? So saving for retirement, good analogy, or whatever it is. There's so many of these different things that can be a good analogy for making a long-term decision. And although it feels, now the difference is that in people with this brain lesion, with these lesions to the medial frontal part of the brain, that without this part of the brain, they were actually unable to link the stress of the risky decision making with the cost or the pain of the result of that decision. So what they did is they actually connected people to skin conductance, so in other words, a stress marker of the body. And when you make the choice of the deck, they actually delay telling you how you did. So you have this anticipatory stress response where you pick a deck and it takes just a few seconds before they tell you if you won or lost. And what happens is that in people who are neurologically sound or intact, who don't have these lesions, that when you pick from the risky decks, your stress response goes up considerably between picking the deck and finding out what you got, right? And soon the difference between the risky decks and the safer decks grows apart, increases. So that soon you're learning from the stress response, you're being slowly conditioned, isn't exactly the best word, but you're in a way being conditioned that the riskier decks come with more pain. And the difference with the lesion,
they were amygdala lesions?
No, medial frontal, medial prefrontal.
So it was the top-down decision-making, not the fear stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that what's funny is that what's literally was missing in the patients was emotion. They were literally missing the emotion. They were literally missing that feeling of like, oh, that's a risky decision, that was not training them.
Like literally emotion in the technical sense.
Yeah,
the term.
Literally. From
the bottom up. Yeah.
Exactly. Literally missing emotion. And this story, it takes a little bit for the power of that result to sink in. This is a great example of one result, many implications. Like it's very simple.
That's what I was going to ask you, Glenn, is could you break down, to tie a bow on this, can you break down some of those implications for folks of this experiment?
Well, one, I'm about to start embarking on a giant book on intuition. And I'm really interested in how does intuition work over long stretches of time, right? Not like look down the alley, get a weird feeling, but how, like, you know, I get the sense that I want to write a book at the intersection of neuroscience and sports 10 years before I even come up with West of Jesus. You know what I mean? Like that. So how does that work over time? It's the same screening process that we're talking about, right? Inverted, my body is using to pick, or my to pick is guiding intuition over time, hypothetically, is just one simple example. So tucked into there is a deeper understanding of insight and intuition, how the subconscious processes information. You learn a shitload about fear systems and decision making. Also, it opened, if I'm not mistaken, it opened an entire, like, there's a whole new wing of neural economics that sort of came out of that, correct?
Absolutely. It really, it has meaning even extending into how we do everything, right? It's how we learn. It has everything to do with how we develop moral and value judgments. It has to do with gratitude. My main area of focus is research is on gratitude.
Can I ask a super geeky Iowa gambling test neural question?
Yeah.
So in folks without lesions to the medial prefrontal, do you see, I know when you get norepinephrine in the lateral amygdala, the first spot in the amygdala, like right where it shows up, that's just salience, right? So you would get that from turning over a card. At that point, it's not anxiety. It's not excitement. It's just, hey, there might be something my brain wants to learn later, right? At a certain point in the amygdala, probably by the time it's in like the basal amygdala, the next two steps in the like chain and the connectivity change, it becomes anxiety, right? That's what you see, unless there's an anandamide in the system, is my understanding. My question is, have we done imaging work on the amygdala while people are doing the Iowa gambling task, I guess, is my first question. I'm assuming Antonio has, because that's just sort of his thing. I could be wrong.
You know, to be honest, I have to look at the literature a little bit more to know exactly what the amygdala is doing during Iowa gambling. My prediction is that it's going to be kind of holding steady and then decreasing as people land on a better strategy, right?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm wondering is I want to know, is it decreasing after we get conscious awareness or when does it start decrease? Like, I agree with you.
No, it'll be early, right? Because it's one of those intersections, the amygdala is one of those intersections with our favorite, you know, in the Damasio sphere, our favorite thing is the brainstem. And the amygdala being so tightly coupled to it, you know, these things are all happening massively and it's so massively parallel. It's hard to really grip when it comes to the brain. Part of why it's so hard to understand how the brain works is that these things are happening really, really, really at the same time. Like it's so massively parallel. And you have amygdala and brainstem just...
By the way, Rian, let me point out that Glenn is, I believe, the only person I know who can actually, because he's in this brainstem group, one, he's probably the only guy I know who can tell you what the pons does. He can also probably talk learnedly about the reticular activating system, which most people really screw up, probably me included. And if you're really nice, he'll tell you about the periocular gray.
Oh, that's the whole region. That's the whole brain. The para-aqueductal gray. Oh man, that's the one. And that the nucleus tractus solitarius, NTS. Actually, there's three. Although it's hard to pick a favorite. If you want a fun one, actually, you guys would like this for emotion regulation for flow state. A really good one is locus coeruleus, right? So part of norepinephrine.
I think so. One of the things that's really interesting, anandamide and the endocannabinoid system. We know it's active in flow because there's been really good work that's found that. I've been working really hard with a number of people trying to figure out what it does. And it seems like, so I don't know if you know this or not, there's a CB1 receptor, an anandamide receptor in the locus coeruleus. There's also one, there's like four in the amygdala. Anandamide is synthesized on site. Right? It's not made elsewhere. Like the locus coeruleus makes our norepinephrine and shoots it up to the medial prefrontal cortex. Anandamide synthesized on site. So one of the things we know for sure is anandamide is a master stress regulator. And when you get anandamide in the amygdala at the same time as norepinephrine, it downregulates. This is really geeky, but it downregulates both GABA and glutamate, which is a fancy way of saying it just totally shuts off reactivity in the amygdala. Once that happens, there's another CB1 receptor in the locus coeruleus that shuts down. So you basically, if you have anandamide in the amygdala, the entire brain's fear response from the neurochemical level is shut down. And we think when you go into flow, that's happening. That's one of the mechanisms.
I think it's a good hypothesis. I mean, that's why I love the topic of flow and the brain so much, and why I think it's such a great neurocognitive neuroscience question. It's so interesting because flow, it's hard to capture, and it's going to be really hard to capture in the brain, you in the brain scanner or with any of the things that can disrupt it. And you know, you can wear a portable EEG while somebody's doing something, but then even that kind of interferes with them. And then the EEG
looking at FMIR data. FMIR data has a lot less, there's less artifacts. So we were just actually talking about it yesterday because we're building, you know, we're building and buying some gear to really take a bigger stab at this. And we want to get a transient hypofrontality, right? So it's less about the brainwaves and flow. There's been a bunch of work. Everybody's pretty happy with the alpha theta borderline 8 to 10 hertz. Like, I don't think that's really a question. There are questions about like, where is it coming out of? And like, I think you're going to get a 10 hertz alpha signal out of the amygdala when anandamide shows up and it shuts down, and it's testable. Here's a prediction. It's testable. We can go test this. We can measure, et cetera, all besides the point. But we're trying to solve the motion thing with FMIR stuff. And I just like saying that word. I don't even know how you spell it.
Glenn, I want to bring us back for a second to, I think folks have a little bit of an open loop here around the gambling test. You were touching on the implications, and then you mentioned pre-hunch. It sounded like you were about to touch on gut instinct or intuition as potentially, or at least emotionally driven decision-making as part of the implications. Could you close that thought around the implications of the Iowa gambling test and the idea of a pre-hunch?
It's so translatable into everything that we learn, from how we relate to other people, from how we gain even a skill like that's motoric, or a motor skill, even something like juggling or playing music. It all has to come from a place where you're learning to feel what the right thing is to do. And you learn to feel the right decision. And I mean that literally, because your emotion is what's causing a stimulus, which we feel and experience. It takes some time to sink in, but notice how certain people in our lives, so gratitude is a great, great test case in this, and there's so many more open hypotheses for this, but think about how you learn to feel better when you're around certain people. What is that? You can't put a quantified number on it. Even imagine how much it would get in the way if you said, oh, every time I see Steven, he gives me $10. He doesn't. But imagine that. You'd be like, that's weird. What? Why would he do that? Compared to saying, man, I just feel good around this people. I feel good around people like Steven and Rian because we have such good idea flow. We feel good. What? How do you quantify that? You don't. You can't.
Well, let me ask you a question. You could quantify if we had really good access to dopamine, norepinephrine, oxytocin, endorphins, possibly acetylcholine, a couple of, right? Like if we could actually just, oh, we've got neurochemical levels in the brain, you theoretically could quantify that. We can't currently with the technological limitations very well, but it's theoretically possible, right?
Well, you could quantify the emotion, right? You could quantify the signals and the physical. This is in the weeds, but this is a very nuanced point. It's very nuanced. It takes some sinking in. So if you're out there listening to this and you're thinking, what in the world? It actually in itself is an analogy. If you're thinking about this and you're not quite sure, just keep thinking about what we're saying and see it in your life. So this, even this hypothesis of how these things work, even it requires feeling. We can probably quantify an imaginary world where we have infinite access to every synapse in the brain, every synapse, every glial cell, everything. That we could start to quantify.
Good. I just have an allergy to the word impossible. I'm sorry. You said we can't quantify. I was like, well, no, come on.
No. What I'm saying that what's with the weird magic, and this is sort of where you have to dive into theories of consciousness, is where it gets hard is to quantify what feeling that emotion actually means. The same way it's hard to quantify what the color red means to you versus me. So you're getting closer to the hard problems of consciousness. It's hard to explain how universal, if I could trigger the exact same, you know, exact same synapses in you and me and everyone, do we feel the exact same thing? That's an open question. That's a very hard question. That I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know anybody who does. But the pragmatic, the practical aspect of the implication of the Iowa gambling task is that it reframes the way we can learn and learn to enjoy our life and the process of learning things, where we can stop trying to overanalyze and over-quantify things and over, you know, try to make things logical that shouldn't be logical, when we can learn to put our logic and our feeling together. We can learn to label emotion for what it is, which is a big tapestry of overlapping experiences, that it's no perfect label for one emotion or another, that these things are overlapping and they're this wonderful, you know, rainbow of things that we can feel in any given circumstance. And that it's learning to pick out and learning to label and learning to think carefully about the emotional feelings we have as we navigate life. That's the power of how we can learn to be better decision makers, how we can learn to get a little better every day, learn to connect with each other more every day. And I think so much of our struggles in life are our inability to deal with emotion, particularly as it pertains to decision making, and particularly how it relates to how we relate to others. We try so hard to put logical bounds and rational bounds on how we relate to each other, how we choose to feel or not feel a connection with someone, when in fact, this really using the logical systems of the brain for something I don't think they're good at. I think really when it comes to learning skills and learning to connect with people, you have to learn to label and identify the full spectrum of emotion that we can have. You know, so gratitude is a good instance where, you know, you learn to feel close to somebody, even if you can't, you know, even if before you know why that person makes you feel so good, you learn to listen to, like, this person I think has, that's where your intuition for people can come from, that you learn to say, I believe this person's intention, or I believe that I feel like I can be a better person around this person. You know, all that is going back to the Iowa gambling test, where we're learning to use emotion for decision-making correctly. And I'm not trying to dissociate these systems. They're in a big old web, but by even putting them together, when we're trying so hard to shut, even there's so much research that when you try to shut your emotion down, when you just try to shut, just deny that you're feeling an emotion, your performance just falls off a cliff. That it takes so much energy just to deny that if we're feeling bad, we spend so much energy trying to deny that we feel bad, carry on and put on a happy face, that we're putting our body in just a constant threat state. You can't.
Glenn, we start every meeting, try to, and I certainly do, with just a 2-second emotional check-in. And it's only to determine, are you feeling something really negative? I can't fix it. But if you tell me you're feeling like shit and you're scared and you say it out loud, the stress of trying to hide it from me massively goes away, and I'm going to get better performance out of you. So, you know, it's a team building thing. We call it a cognitive load check-in when Rian and I do it, right? We just
we'll have to update the title, make it more neuroscientifically accurate.
Let me ask you another question, Glenn, before we go too far away from this. And I know Rian's going to carry us, because as I was listening to you, I think there's another, like, really basic performance lesson in the Iowa gambling test. Andrew Newberg came and hung out with us again a couple weeks ago. He was talking about, he's obsessing on this idea that he thinks is foundational. We're talking about what do peak performers know that other people don't know. And his answer was, well, every peak performer knows that it is always, no matter what, crawl, walk, run. No matter the situation, no matter how good, that's right. So like Michael Jordan, when he comes to something new, it's still crawl, walk, run. Like the best in the world know that there's no escaping crawl. What I like about the Iowa Gambler's Test is it explains that. This is why, right? And it's in my next book, Art of Impossible, I talk about it as the thing that's so awful about learning is you're bad until you're better, right? There's you're bad, 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 and then one day you're better, right? And you, there's not all that just happened is your brain figured out all the patterns. And it's, You know, it's so funny. I've been poking a little bit. I won't take us too far sideways on this, at an operational definition of mastery, because it plays such a big role and blah, blah, blah. And one of the things that there's some really interesting perceptual research that basically says you can't obtain mastery until you understand basically how an object will, like if you're interacting with anything, you need to know how that object is going to move, change light, how it's going to respond to light and gravity, the two things that shape us most as human beings, right? And this is another Andrew Newberg. He said, you know, if you really want to understand the brain, you got to understand how an organ deals with light and gravity, because at an evolutionary perspective, that's where this starts, right? That's the simplest thing. So like those inputs are the primary inputs into the system way back when. I got really sidetracked by that. But it seems to me that some of what we mean by mastery is understanding every possible emotion a thing can make in a situation, you know, all everything that can, and that's what the subconscious is learning, right? That's why it's always crawl, walk, run. And I think the at a really basic, simple level that I think is easier for people to understand, that's exactly why. Because you need 25 cards to just sort of figure out, oh, this is bad voodoo and this is good voodoo, right?
Building on that, Stephen, then I got a question for both of you, which is, how would you neuroscientifically answer the question, how do I tune into or go with my intuition more?
How do you get the insula to work for you rather than against you? It's a good question for Scott Barry Kaufman, by the way, because he's our resident default mode expert, but kick it over to Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, you know what it is. You have to learn to listen to it. You know, that it's about removing distraction, and it's really about having space for creativity. It's about turning off the editor. It's about having something, having ritual, and having fun. Fun is so underrated, especially in this performance world. Like, you do it like peak performance, like, have some fun. It's okay. Have some fun. So if you're having fun doing something, you're probably going to learn a good amount. And this is the flow thing, right? Like,
by the way, Glenn fills the slot in the our roster of the affective neuroscience tradition, which means he traces his lineage one way or another back to Jacques Poncet, who is the play guy from the start. So you can't do, like, of course you're going to bring it. And of course, like, we love it too, but your roots are showing.
You know, and well, I mean, it's my person, it's who I am, is that if I weren't here, if I didn't have the baby and you give me something to do today, I'm going to go work on my truck. I have an old Chevy truck that I'm restoring and I feel like $1 million and I can clear my whole mind. I can get such clarity. I spend a day sanding a truck or, you know, tuning a carburetor. There's the whole element of emotion regulation, fear regulation. You know, you don't want to mess up something. And when you create something, you have this process where you have to sort of let go. Stephen, you've been talking about this on Twitter about the writing process, right? You have to have, if you want to create something, it goes back to this logical thing. Logically, you know what you create at first will be imperfect, right? Logically. And, or whatever, grant me just some assumption that you have to put something imperfect into the world to develop it into something perfect. That in itself is kind of an illogical thing, but we can sort of use some metacognition to say, okay, that's part of the process of how we got to go there. But if you refuse to put something out there that you don't think is good enough, or if you're shooting on yourself the whole time, I should be this, I should do that, I should be better. Again, those inhibitories are pushing us into a threat state, right? That is going to limit creativity. And sure enough, what you create won't be as good. You know, I think it's so important that whatever you need to do to trigger that thing, I also think to trigger the sense of stopping to edit yourself.
Well, there's also, you know, this was sort of, I take pride in this particular one because Scott Barry Kaufman, who works with us, who's a colleague, and Dr. Andrew Newberg, who's a colleague, put out a paper recently. I don't remember where it ran. I didn't run in Nature because I mistakenly told somebody it ran in Nature and it didn't because they checked. But they were looking at neural imaging. Rhian, I'm going to tie this back to your question. I'm coming back to you. It's what I'm doing here. They looked at the neural imaging on eminent creatives, right? What's the functional connectivity, meaning the network brain map of eminent creatives? And what they found is, and this is the specific, you ask a question of how can you get better at interior reception, right? What you see is, normally, most people, the executive attention network, which is, I'm using this to pay attention to you right now, right? It's top down, outside directed, is in opposition to the default mode network, or what Scott Berry likes to call the imagination network, which is that interior signal, right? That's what you, and in eminent creatives, you see both of those networks active at the same time. Normally, one goes up and the other goes down, and it works like this. But in eminent creatives, you see them both active at once, along with the salience network, which is what allows you to detect novelty in the environment. And those three things, when you can get them working together, this is how you do that. And Glenn is absolutely 1,000% right. Like, almost everything we know about how to do that involves training you to be more creative, right? Like, what you're going for, which is, I pay more attention to my internal signals. Certainly mindfulness is great for that, that, like, it was developed for that amount, right? There's that practices, but where you really, I think all the meditation in the world will not get you where creativity will get you, because creativity is applied. You're taking those internal signals and you're turning them to something. And it, meditation is, I'm paying attention to it. Creativity is, I'm studying it. I'm really learning it and I'm turning it into something. And Glenn, I totally agree with you. You have to keep the dorsal lateral, the inner critic portion of the prefrontal, totally calm down, right? This is why you want executive attention on a little bit so you can focus, but you want it as quiet as possible, because otherwise you're going to shit all over yourself. And I will, to go back to the final thing you said, just because I want people to understand that there's a way to, you can do this anywhere. I do it with writing. When I train people to write, I talk about a three levels. I say there's three. First, level one, vomit the shit onto the page. Just get it out there. Level two is where you tune in. I like to call it the fact level. It's where I get all my facts right, all my details right. I don't start putting in style, meaning I can no longer make it. I can't make a decision that this is crappy until the style gets in there. And it's the third thing I do. So I have permission to write crap for, and when I, this is usually day one, 4 hours, that's just vomited out. Day two, add in 4 more hours, add in the facts. Day three is adding the style. So I literally have 3 days before I have to judge it at all, right? I built it in. And I think I have found over time, I always tell people that for me, by doing this, and I teach it at Flow for Writers, I have found that what it does for me is increase my speed massively. I write so much faster. People, how do you produce so many books a year? This is how, this exact thing. And the reason is it does exactly what you're talking about, right? It keeps the judgy part of my brain out of the equation. Basically, for I've before I start judging a piece of writing, I'm 12 hours in, right? I've got a half day into a piece of writing, and that's a lot of leeway, right? In the real world, that's, we don't spend 12 hours on a lot of things without judging it. That's a lot of, like, you know what I mean? And often it'll be bad until 11 hours and 58 minutes.
Right, right. You have to give that space in it. You have to think about what we're really judged by in the world is what we produce, right? If you want to build something, you have to produce something. You have to produce more than we consume, you know? And I love that something my mom imparted to me was, try to produce more than you consume every day. And it shouldn't be a judgy moment, but just think, for one thing, there's two sides of that equation, right? Is, what are you consuming and what are you producing? You know, and we produce and we consume creative works, of course, but we also produce and consume love and connection to people. We produce and consume the ability to show someone that we care, show them kindness, so we can produce kindness and compassion in the world, which we should. And we should do that to the degree above whatever we're willing to consume, right? And that is actually, the equilibrium is really higher productivity and lower consumption. You know, and that's in our interpersonal relationships, in our work world. You know, if you want to be a writer, you have to write. You know, I mean, it shouldn't be that you write more books than you read. That's impossible.
Marie and I were talking about this differently from a different angle. And this is going to sound really freaking harsh. This is Stephen probably being an asshole, but I have a real problem with foodie. It's not that I have a problem with good food. Foodie culture bugs me. And the reason is, you can't buy culture. Cooking is culture for the dude who's cooking the food, or the woman who's cooking the food, right? If you go to see dance on a theater, the cultural experience is for the dancers on stage. That's the culture. You're just a consumer of their culture, right? Over the past 20 years, this line has gotten very blurred in society. Somehow we started to believe that consumption, oh, I go check out all these fancy restaurants and these great chefs and I know them by name. You're a consumer. That's not culture. You're not creating a thing. Until you create a thing, you're on the other side of it.
You know, what's funny. Maybe I'm an asshole too, because I think the same exact thing. You ask an audience of people who here has a hobby. This is a huge problem with our world. Who has a hobby? Most people will say, oh, I'd like to go out to eat. And I go, that's great. I love a good food. I live in Los Angeles and I will put Los Angeles as a culinary capital of the world. It's amazing here. It's different than creating something. It's one thing if you're like, oh, I'd like to get in my kitchen. I'm trying to cook the best pad Thai noodles ever. Like, yes, there you go.
Now you're creating culture. Absolutely. Totally.
Yeah, I think that simple shift, that understanding that well-being, joy, satisfaction, meaning comes from production, not consumption across the board is huge.
Exactly. And that's what we see with gratitude, right? That we see that this pay it forward mentality is where gratitude often comes from. That if you want to help yourself, help someone. That old adage is so true that really the fastest way when we're feeling beat up is to try to lend a hand to someone else, you know, and some magic happens. For one thing, you stop editing, you stop thinking of yourself. The most selfish thing we could do is probably try to help other people. It's really, really good news. And even studies go back for altruism in the brain, that the networks of altruism of giving something of yourself, very similar to those of receiving. So it's the fastest way. You can't always count on someone else giving something to you. That's not under your control, but you do have the control to give someone something, and you can give your time. You can give kindness. You don't have to give things that cost money. And in so doing, you are creating more than you're consuming.
Yeah, you got a good mom. By the way, I just want to tell you, because I found this funny, I didn't know where you grew up. My wife's best friend lives in your hometown.
No way.
Sonora.
No
way. She's a forester. So yeah, I mean, she lives there for the pine trees. But yeah, her boyfriend, well, long time, 10-year boyfriend, his family's from there. So you'll probably know her.
Yeah. What are their names?
I'm not going to tell you right now, because I'm worried that they were the fourth graders fucked with you on the playground. Like, I'm worried. Like,
they got kicked out of the tomato club.
You know what I mean? I can say the wrong thing here. And like, I'm not working with the collective anymore. That kid beat me up on recess.
No, I never knew. I wouldn't say that. You know, the thing is that they weren't bullying us. We were going toe-to-toe.
Oh, you were just total hooligans.
Yeah, like this is the part of the resolution of the story. It turns out we were all little redneck kids. Like we just were bullying them. That's why they got so mad. Like we were kind of the bullies in the story, as it turns out.
I was going to ask you that, because you did kind of sound like the bullies in the story. I was going to ask you. So, okay, I got to ask. We got to go back to the story for a couple of seconds for clarification. I'm sorry, Rian. One, I want to talk about the psychological questionnaire that you developed back in fifth grade. So you're 11 years old. Do we know what the questions are still? Do you have any of this material still for the Tomato Club? It's the Tomato Club, right?
Tomato Republic. The Tomato Republic, Stephen.
Okay, so, yeah. So one, as Eddie Izzard would say, yes, but do you have a flag?
we had a logo. No, we had a little logo. We had the whole thing, but we know that the questionnaire was simple, was that I don't remember the questions, but the idea was that you could only get in if you refused to answer any of the questions seriously. So if you didn't take any of the questions seriously, you got in.
And so that was sort of like the Flow Research Collective.
Yeah. So here we are. You know,
here we are. Not much has changed, come to think about it.
So Glenn, you mentioned that you've been boiling up a bit of a universal theory of peak performance. Steven's been doing the same thing for God knows how many years, and it's going to be coming out in the form of his new book in January. If you can kind of paint us a broad picture of it, and then I'd love for Stephen to share his.
By the way, let me pause to say one thing. Over the past 10 years, peak performance has become very visible because of podcasts, because this was a secret thing forever, and suddenly the smartest people on the world are all doing podcasts. So there's comparatives and contrast. We've been doing some kind of meta-analysis of this very phenomenon online. But I think everybody has noticed the same thing, which is, holy crap, everybody's doing, like the people who really know what they're doing, they're all doing similar things. And the reason is everything you could possibly mean by peak performance is just getting the biology to work for you rather than against you. So it now, like, there's enough visibility. We're like, oh, wait a minute, we can see the systems. Sure, there's some functional connectivity questions and how the fields of the brain are working together that we don't have a freaking clue. And there's that Robert Sapolsky level of like how the epigenome impacts receptors. And like, we don't have a clue. But other than that, like, with, you know what I mean? Like, there's enough that's visible that you actually, I don't know if I'm right. I don't know if you're right. But I think a lot of people are, who are in this field are starting to go, holy crap, this is possible because we can see all of it for the first time.
Yeah. No, we need to collaborate. I mean, I think that's the answer, Stephen, is we need to collaborate. So I say that with a bit of a tongue in cheek, right? That,
well, no, I mean, Glenn, I would tell you, by the way, Scott Barry Kaufman's Transcendence, right? It's not a book technically on peak performance, right? It's a book on humanistic philosophy and ideas of transcendence, but pretty much, I mean, he's got a chapter on love and a couple things that I don't really focus on, but there's nothing missing. You know what I mean? It's not, my version is done into peak performance or whatever, but I was reading this book and I was like, yeah, there's more, I'm focused more on goal directed stuff and you're more on love because it's, you know, but like, it's all, I think, as I said, a lot of us are seeing the same, you know, same thing. And so I do think that's going to be, I think, you know, in our lifetime, definitely in your lifetime, maybe not mine, but.
Well, that depends on how our biohacking goes, right?
That's true. And yeah. I'm planning on living a long frickin' time. So,
yeah. I mean,
my lifetime, if I live it till, you know, next January 12th, my book comes out, I'll prove myself wrong on this one.
That's what we're cheering for. Look, let me say, I think there's room for a few different things in this space. So, I'll start with two things that I think are good, and then I'll talk about my little hypothesis. Let's not even call it a theory, we'll call it a hypothesis. But that, for one thing, two questions that I don't have answers for, and then I'll talk about the thing that I'll lead everyone on. First question I don't answer for, I want a new word for mindset.
Again, the question I ask every time somebody says this is, what the hell is the difference between a mindset and a locus of control? Didn't we used to call it locus of control? Isn't mindset just a new word for locus of control? Am I missing something?
I mean, I think, no, actually, no, those are close enough. The problem is that it's missing the conception of emotion, right? It's not a mindset. It's a body set. And it's not a set. It's a fluid. You know, it's by setting ourselves. And I know what people mean when they say it. And I use the word all the time. I use it. And I don't like using it. It's a body
set. So wait, you want to replace mindset with body fluid?
Communities.
Different. You see what I mean, right? We need a word for it. Wow. I walked right into that one.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
So good. That's it. That's what it is. So we need to work on your body.
I'm going to adopt it. Glenn Fox tells me I got to work on my body fluid.
Yeah. There's
I joined the Tomato Republic and my body fluid's a lot of whack. And, you know, is there a class I could take or something?
Well, you know, what we do in our spare time, you know, it's up to you. But
yeah, where you're going, Glenn, with that is great. I think
it's hilarious. It really does ourselves a disservice to focus so much on mind in the sense of what we're really talking about is metacognitive skill building, right? Metacognitive skill, how we think about thinking. And the skill of thinking about our thinking, that's really what it is, mindset. That's really what a lot of the mindset is in a nutshell. You know, it's that locus of control is sort of breaking down what we can control in a situation. Self-efficacy, very similar. How can I take the tools to be effective? Optimism, how can I make the best of this shit sandwich, right? Those are metacognitive frameworks.
Quick, because we talked about, on our last conversation, we've talked a lot about gratitude as a sort of a radical reframing thing. Do you think of mindset, is mindset, and I like everything you've just lumped in with there, I totally agree. Do you think it's a frame or is it something different? And if it's a frame, we say mindset as an anatomy guy, do we think mindset actually does most of its work? I think it's a bottom-up thing. I don't think when we talk about mindset, I don't think medial prefrontal cortex, I literally think that those deep brainstem regions we were talking about earlier. And I think the thalamus, I think sensory gating is what that's the level we're talking about. Am I do you think I'm wrong there?
That's where I'm interested. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's what I'm interested in. That's exactly what I'm interested in, because when you, let's say I'm about to go.
Oh, I love that idea. Let's test this. I'm so fascinated by this. Yeah.
Well,
I want to work on this.
You can test this, right? Because let's say I have to give a talk. Like before I was on today, I was super excited. I was telling my wife, I'm nervous. I'm excited, right? Because it's really fun to connect and show ideas. So what I'm doing outside, like when I'm going, is like, okay, I want to be focused. I want to be helpful so that anybody who's listening can walk away a little bit better, right? So what I'm doing is I'm setting my mind or my framing for things, but I do believe it's sort of a bottom up thing that you start to go into the challenge and threat state is extremely important. Starting to shove your body into a challenge state, right? Especially when you can, to start to take.
It comes into the chain before fear gets there. Like if you have the right mindset, it's going to come in as challenge and not fear, right? And if fear is something that takes place at the amygdala medial prefrontal level, you got to go before that. And the only thing before that is the thalamus or the sense organs themselves.
Exactly. And so that's where I think it's a good term is what's your mindset going into this. I get it as a sort of colloquialism, but what you're doing is you're setting a preparation of your body, right? You're preparing to take a stressor as a challenge and not a threat, right? So going into public speaking is probably the thing most people would need help with in our lives. Like very few people are going to be dropping cliffs like you, Stephen, in your spare time into the Tahoe backcountry, right? Which you know you do, right? And like that's similar, but for most people, it's probably public speaking. It's probably some sort of business atmosphere that really triggers them and maybe personal relationships, right?
By the way, let's be clear. I don't mind dropping the clips of the backcountry. Put me in a business meeting on Wall Street. Yeah, that's the room I don't like.
Right. And so, yeah, so these things can flip us, right? Also shows how nonlinear our fear and emotion systems are, again, with the logic and reasoning thing, right? That logically speaking, like, why does our body treat those things the same, right? Because there's a whole discussion there in itself. But a lot of ways our stress response, when we're faced with a stress, it can go challenge or threat on this continuum. Check out Jim Blaskovich's work, UC Santa Barbara. It's brilliant. Just there's not enough on it. Like peak performance literature, I think where locus of control is one thing, but this challenge and threat physiology is so good. It's so explanatory and it's so modern. And
well, one of the things I was talking to somebody else about this very thing today, if you look, so challenge skills balance is the number one flow trigger, right? But what the hell do you mean by challenge and skills has been a long time question that a ton of people, a lot of the European flow researchers in the 90s into the early 2000s, there was like a 15-year period where everybody like that was what they did. What the hell do we mean by challenge and what do we mean by skills? And a lot of people worked on it. And you know, if you look at the full list, it's almost the full list of mindset. It's the ability to delay gratification. It's optimism, all this stuff. It's also culture, right? There's a reason like Nietzsche, Freud, Jung, all these people said, hey, culture, you got to get break free of your culture before you can perform at your best. Though Freud said you had to get free of your culture until you can love. But basically the same ideas if you knew what Freud meant by love, right? The point is, how do you measure the impact of culture? Like, what does that look like? And what you're talking about, mindset as a bottom-up, brainstem, that thalamic level, you could measure this, that you could actually look at that. Or maybe Jim Blaskovich has looked at it, and I'm the last to know.
I don't know about culture. Culture is always, sadly, it should be one of the first things we look at, the influence of culture on these things. And it's often the last thing. You know, it's one thing I've found that as something... I'm not an academic thoroughbred, right? I'm from a pretty hard scrabble background, and it drives me up a wall when you hear other researchers and people talking about, you know, empathy or even pro-social themes and social justice themes from very much a perspective of someone who simply went Ivy League straight through to professor and now they're telling you, and I just go, man, you were missing the boat, because there's so much more texture in the varieties of ways that people develop that we have to reach people at. And it's got to affect our research. It has to affect the way we talk about science. I mean,
Glenn, I will tell you, and you're welcome to sit in on any of these meetings. So I have built, we haven't really talked about this out loud, but we built an athlete roster of athletes who work. They all gone through Zero to Dangerous or going through it. And mostly it's because we want to study peak performance at the top level. We need to train them up in the science so they can talk to us about it. And it's really a bunch of top science-minded athletes. But I have chosen people from all over the world. We've got folks from Uganda. We've got folks from the Philippines. We've got folks from any place you could possibly draw people from. And the reason is they're all top athletes and they're all versed in flow and now flow science. So maybe we can start to answer this question, right? Like what the hell is culture doing? And we also, by the way, we're allowed to run research experiments on them. That's part of the thing. So I have a group of, 20 of the best athletes in the world that we could run science on.
Glenn, can we go back to the thought on your universal therapy performance mindset to bodily fluid? Can you fully break that down for us?
Here's what I'll say is something that I think can help folks out. So when I teach a class, the science of peak performance, and I've developed a very simple framework, and I'm not calling it the universal theory of peak performance per se. I'm just being a little silly when I do that. But what it really breaks down to, I call it the heart command lift approach. And it's not all encompassing. There's gaps in it. I'm still developing it. But really, if we're having struggles coming up with something where we're feeling affected, where we're feeling like we're built to handle the things we want to do in life, where we're holding ourselves back in many ways, that it's usually some element of heart. That's our motivation, right? That's gratitude, purpose, and optimism, right? It's like, what's in our heart for what we want to do things? That has to be foremost, I think, before we really attack something, the why, as you will. I mean, I'm so sick of hearing about it, but it is really important that you have to go to the deeper causes for what's going to push you through the tough stuff. Then you have to develop your skills. You have to be good at it. That's command, right? You have to have command of your skill set. So there you can look at your expertise, look at your habits, look at your goals, look at all those different things that you can break down for attacking and sort of metacognitively framing the development of the skills, the walk, crawl, or the crawl, walk, run, growth trajectory, progression through the skills you need to be good at something. And then you have to go for it. You have to have lift. So lift, I love lift because of the physics of it's velocity through a medium, right? That it's pushing through resistance that creates lift. This is where I want to work with the FRC more, is with your F1 and Formula One and really high performance racing drivers. The inverse of lift is downforce, right? That it's speed that allows the aerodynamics of the car to actually gain traction. And there's so many things in our life where you have to have a complete foot on the floor mentality that will actually allow you to go around the corner at the speed you need, where you're going past what you think the ordinary physics will maintain. That you're going into the corner so quickly, you know the tires themselves won't grip, and you know that if you overdrive the tires but underdrive your aerodynamics, you could slip. But with enough speed, you get the tire grip, you get the aerodynamic downforce that takes you through the corner. You know, those things of the sort of the commitment to going for it when you're not sure, when you know that only complete commitment will get you there. And then all kinds of things can happen, of course. There's never a guarantee, but when you have to completely put your foot down, whether or not that's launching a business, that's, you know, having a hard conversation with somebody, it's whatever it is, getting a PhD, right? Or all the different things at the points in my life where, you know, you don't come from my background and go get a PhD from Antonio Damasio through just rational things of, oh, I have this skill set, therefore I can go for it. It's always running behind your skill set. I believe that the most fun things are where your skill set is running behind your past ability to actually do something, where you have to go a little past what you think you can actually do to see what you are. That's one thing where I love like figure skating. So I love like big air snowboard competitions. These things where they're taking off on the run or they're starting their routine, they don't totally know for sure that they're going to be able to do everything they're going to try to do at the highest level, right? Isn't that amazing? Like, they're not sure they're going to land all those tricks, but they know that if they do, that's the only way that they're going to win, is they've got to land stuff that they're pretty sure they can do. you know, but if they only do the stuff that they're sure they can do, they'll never get up there. So that element of lift, that's where it kind of culminates. You have the lift, you're going for it, you're putting yourself out, and you're really competing against yourself, and you're competing against what you think you're actually capable of doing, combined with the motivation that, you know, if you should fail, you can respond psychologically healthily, that if you fall short, you still have a good framework to know it's part of a deeper purpose of growth, of all these different things, the things you're grateful for, the people who help you get where you're trying to go. And then it fills back into the skills that you need of like, oh, well, I need to work on this aspect of public speaking. My slides weren't good, or I didn't do enough research before I stepped into this meeting, or maybe you're a figure skater and you need to work on a few different aspects of your form or whatever. But this sort of heart command lift model, it's not perfect. It has a few gaps in it, but it's a great place to start to look at if we're falling short of stuff. Is it you're just not sticking your neck out and you need to work on your lift? Is it you're not quite like, oh, I just want to work on my skills? And these aren't linear, circular things. These are just ways to sort of break things down.
I will tell you, one of the things that I found that's very much in keeping with this is where you train flow in this process is an open, there's a motivation grit component, right? Which is your heart component. You got to get your motivations right. You got to get your goals right. You got to have your grit component. In an ideal world, if you're coming to peak performance, that is absolutely where you'd start. We've discovered people want to learn flow first. They want the high from flow that you can get, and then they're willing to do the work to get the motivation line and that sort of stuff. And that certainly seems to be the case. And one of the things that I always tell people is fear is a phenomenal motivator. It's a great motivator. It's awesome. You get focus for free, right? Massive amounts of focus for free. But you can only use it effectively, really effectively, after you've lined up all your intrinsic motivators, after you've got grit, because it will override this. Without those things, it will win. But once those things are in place, like, you know, I say this a lot, the best of the best always use fear as a compass, right? What scares me the most? Great, that's the direction I'm going to go in, right? You see it over and over, and it's because you get focus for free. But that does not mean you want to start out risk-taking at the front end of your peak performance career. You really, literally do not. It will screw you up. You want to start work. Fear is something, I mean, you got to work with it all along, of course, but I don't think you can really grapple with it until you're there. The other thing I just wanted to mention, I don't think it's just race car driving. I think there's something fundamental in what you were saying about speed. And the first pro skier I ever skied with, and I've been skiing my whole life, right? I went to Europe. I was a young reporter. I was 23, 24. I was in Chamonix with the Egans and the Deloriers. They were two groups of brothers. They were early Warren Miller, first generation extreme skiers, right? And I'm with the Warren Miller crew. We're in Chamonix. And I thought I was an expert skier. So it was clear to me, like, I was terrible. Like, oh my God, like how I, you know, it was an unfathomable, humbling, awful experience for me. And at the end of it, Johnny Egan, one of the guys who was there, I was like, dude, how do you do what you do? Like, what's the secret? He said, I'm going to tell you the secret. This is the absolute secret to peak performance in skiing and probably everything else. And I was like, okay, man, you know, what is it? He's like, you go as fast as you can until you fall down. That's how you get better. And And at the time, I actually thought he was talking to me about courage and bravery and fear. And that some of it was that. But what he was actually saying is what you don't know is the equipment is designed to work at speed. So if you're not skiing at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour or snowboarding, mountain biking for that matter, your equipment is actually not working properly. You have no idea what your equipment does because it doesn't start working. It can't because of how it's built until you get to a certain speed. He was actually giving me technical information that sounded like this, like fear-based bro, just go as fast as you can and that's how you get better. Some of it was that, but more of it was, dude, the equipment works at speed and you don't know what's possible. Stuff that looks impossible to you right now is actually tech easy once the equipment is working for you. And he was really right. But you have to be willing to go 50, 60, 70 miles an hour on the gear before you find out that, oh, I can do that. But I also think, I think that's true across, I think there's more to this question of acceleration, right? Andy, I'll give you another one that's interesting. Andrew Huberman, who was, you know, ophthalmologist, pointed out that when we're moving forward, right, we're built to move forward, it downregulates the sympathetic system, right? So you're, when we're moving forward, we're less likely to be afraid. We're built to do that. So I think, like in your lift category, you know, there's a lot of things that, and I think it's a mysterious thing in peak performance. It's not like whatever we're talking about here that fits into this category, I don't think anybody knows what it is.
And it's not going to be linear, right? One of my favorite internal mottos is assume nonlinearity. You know, that it's these things, that's what I like about the downforce, you know, go fast, lift kind of thing, that, yeah, you can overcook the books too, right? You could do 100 miles an hour and then, yeah, no, there's no equipment that'll work for that, right? That you have to assume nonlinearity for anything that comes with the mind or the brain. You have to assume that it's not going to go 1:1:1:1:1:1:1:1. I don't know any system in the brain that just has some infinite, nice linear curve. Everything is step function. Everything is exponential. Everything is like a slow slope, you know, whatever. Parabolic, you know, quadratic, name it, that you always have to assume nonlinearity to really understand where things are. It really frees us up a lot, especially if you can think, oh, we really want things to have this linear function. When you break off that prior, that, oh, if I put in X amount of effort, I'll get X, Y back. You don't know. Maybe it takes X to the X squared to get one, but then if you put that's, you know, a little more, you're going to get where.
I say it slightly. I always tell people the hardest thing and the most amazing thing about peak performance is that it works like compound interest. And you never know, right? Because you don't know. It could, right? All I can tell you is if you do these six things every day and these seven things every week, and I really do think it's that the list is that's what it is, consistently over time. At some point in the next year to 2 to 3 years, you're going to be moving so goddamn fast, you had no idea how you got there. But I can't tell you when it's going to happen. I can't, right? And everybody is totally, totally different. I mean, if you think the brain is nonlinear in a complex system, right? Let's actually talk about the whole human. You know, it's a mess.
Yeah, Stephen, that analogy and that quote, the equipment was built for speed, I just think is epic. I think that's one of our next t-shirts for sure.
The equipment was built for
speed. Yeah, it's great. Glenn, we got to wrap up. I got one question for you to do so. Maybe you do as well, Stephen, before we peace out. So we've actually asked you our research genie question before, I believe, on one of our live calls. So I'm curious to ask you a slightly modified version, which is within your model of heart, command, lift, what's the biggest open question you have within that model? What gap do you feel is most open there?
Well, really how you can train the lift component. I mean, how these things go together, right? Because I think that those three components they're going to play a role in any human pursuit. You know, to me, the open question is, of course, you know, how do they go together? What's missing from the model? And I think this is too vague of an answer, so I apologize, but I'm really interested in things where the language runs out.
Oh, he's giving all Wittgensteinian and shit on us, Rand.
We're really impoverished when it comes to the amount of, to the language that we have around emotion and performance. What I really want to do, the open question to me is, how can this serve as a functional diagnostic framework for teams, for people, for anything? And the question is, it might not, or my big question is, can you take illogical problems and solve them with logic, right? And performance and human pursuit is oftentimes illogical, but you get somewhere where you're like, wow, like incredible. It can help in something. I know it can help, but I don't know where it would go. That would be my question. I know it sounds funny because I cooked it up for the last 5 years.
When you say diagnostic, because this is something I've always thought about flow, and I don't know if it's right, but it's just a hunch, and it's just my question to you. My final question, though. My other question is: are you starting to sleep at night? Because I haven't called you to ask you ridiculous neuroscience questions in like 2 or 3 months, and I'm sort of going through withdrawal. So, like, I don't want to bug you if you're still in daddyhood, because I know people are funny about children. I don't have any or like them, but people tell me they're funny about them. So I don't want to get in your space. So my real question is, could I call you again and ask you really weird questions about the reticular activating system? But okay, Mike, very quick question then is, when you say a diagnostic, I have often believed that if people come to me, they want to, can you give me my workers a flow diagnostic and tell me who are my high flow workers? And I'm like, first of all, I think it's biological. I think we're all high flow workers if the conditions are right. What I think you can develop a diagnostic for, and it's only going to work, like it'll work this year and then next year it'll be a different thing. But I think you could pick the right job, right? The right thing to do, vocation, hobby, whatever it is. I think you can get the fit right. What economists or David Epstein would call match quality. I think you can get match quality right for peak performance. I think that is possible. But the other stuff, I don't know. So my question is, do you mean the other stuff? Or do you mean like a match quality diagnostic?
A little more on the latter, the match quality. I mean, here's what I would say is that what it is, it might not be a diagnostic that leads us to better performance per se, but it might lead us to closer to the source of joy, that this is what's holding us back. So a diagnostic to say, if you really don't know why you're doing the work you're doing, or if your teams don't know why they're doing the work they're doing, your performance is going to go down, right? If you're saying that we're just going to expand into this market, I'm using too many some corporate words, but for anything, right? If you're saying the Flow Research Collective is going to work, we're going to study the influence of eating a banana peel before running a mile, we're like, what? But if you have a really good purpose, a really good, meaning behind it, maybe you can get something there. So I do believe, I think it doesn't get you the whole thing, but these people, for so many folks, we struggle so often on how to put any words and labels on these things, that I consider this just to be maybe for people who are just beginning to think about these things. You have a little bit of a wrapper to go, does everybody here know why that we're grateful that everyone's here? I'm grateful that everyone's a part of this team. If you don't have that, it's going to be hard to build psychological safety, which we know is an extremely important component of performance. Am I grateful? Am I truly grateful for everyone that's here, even if they're not the best, or even if they don't really care if they're here? I'm just glad that, hey, they put their butt in their seat around me. We can work with that. Does everyone here know why we're doing what we're doing, like it or not, right? Or does anyone here have a problem with motivating themselves for why it's important that they do the things we do? We've gotten, in my research, I have this team of undergraduates coding handwritten data from the Marine Corps, right? And this is extremely boring.
Take a look, by the way, at all the things that you say psychological safety and you're looking for. Go take a look at Group Genius by Keith Sawyer and all of the group flow goals. I've been saying this for a while. Psychological safety is group flows, triggers, reinvented with a new term. And there's actually probably, anyways, take a look at that and keep going with that.
Yeah, no, thank you. So group flow is important. Anyway, so what I want to say is that, I think for folks who are maybe just starting to look at these things, starting to think about things, all I want to say with this heart command lift framework is maybe this gives some language around what you're seeing. For my students who are USC seniors and they're so great, they have so much energy, they have so much vim, they're really cool, they're so great. And by giving them this language, they're learning to label and pull apart maybe some of the things where they're holding back a little bit, right? And learning to break, because everything we learn is really in the command side, is get good at this skill, get good at this thing. But they're really not taught too much about handling failure, handling setback, right, from the lift component of things. They're not taught about how to use motivation to push you through things. And people come up with it because they're smart. People come up with it on their own. And the people that really develop a deeper motivation in whatever it is that they do have an advantage of those who do not. So by putting a label on it, it begins to add some language to it. Now, I would say, think about some of the highest peak performing people in the world. Do they have all three of these components? Do they have all three? Well, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what someone's motivation is. You think of like an Alex Honnold, right? Who we interviewed at USC a few years ago, and he's amazing, right? He's amazing. And he's so brilliant, but it's hard to get at his motivation. It's hard to get at it. It's that whole movie was like, well, dude, what are you doing? You know? And he's like, I just climb rocks, guys. Like, I don't know.
I have to talk to Alex later today.
You know, if you stop following Alex Honnold around, he's going to climb rocks tomorrow. He climbs rocks. And like, this was the subtext of our whole interview with him. And I didn't do a great job in that interview, honestly. And that's it. But so, you know, does this model apply to Alex Honnold? I don't know. You know, where is it? I don't know. But imagine that if you're just starting out, use those three things. Let me know how it goes, right? Because I'm just kind of pushing this together. Maybe those three things can give you some idea of, boy, I feel like I've worked really hard to get good at this. I feel like I'm going to put my mind out there, but my heart's not in it. That happens with a lot of athletes, by the way, a lot of athletes. You know, look at Andre Agassi, is like these quotes about how much he hated.
Yeah, I was going to say, Agassi is the counter to this, because this is a guy who hated tennis. He had like, there's no heart whatsoever. Like, he couldn't stand his sport.
So I think a lot of it has to go back to a lack of self-criticism. You know, that sometimes you do get involved in things and you got to push through without a lot of motivation. So this is not meant to be a self-judgy thing. You don't have to have all these things lined up to feel good about yourself and where you got to go. But maybe you're on the pursuit of a new goal. Maybe you're starting a new job, or maybe you lost your last job and need some kind of new compass. I think having some idea to add some labels, that's my goal here.
Guys, you both made my job nice and easy today. You were both on fire. So thanks a million, Jen, for joining us. It was great to have you. No doubt you're already a regular, but I hope that.
Yeah, you're a regular. You're coming back soon.
Please. I hope so. And thanks so much, Stephen.
Jeff, so great to see you. Ryan, thank you. Great job, as always.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Glenn. Great to see you, boss. Take it easy. Hey there, Ryan here. I wanted to tell you about Zero to Dangerous, our flagship peak performance training here at the Flow Research Collective. If you want to guard against distraction, if you want to put into practice the sorts of neuroscience-based practices that we've been talking about in this episode and really integrate them fully into your life so that you can work towards spending your entire workday deep in that zone, fully honed in and focused and wildly productive in flow, then consider applying for Zero to Dangerous. If you end up being accepted into Zero to Dangerous, you will end up working one-on-one with one of our PhD level peak performance coaches. These are folks like Glenn, who you may have seen or heard on our podcast, and they'll help you shift into that sixth gear that you do not even know you have yet, so that you can accomplish your biggest, boldest goals faster. So if this is of interest to you, if you want to train with us and go deeper on all of this stuff, then go to getmoreflow.com, pop your application for Zero to Dangerous through, and we will speak with you to see if it's a good fit and fill you in with more info on how it all works. So that's getmoreflow.com to apply for Zero to Dangerous.